6 माह. सो नाउ वी आर एट द एंड ऑफ द चैप्टर ऑन द नॉलेज एंड द इग्नोरेंस. दो शोरबिंदो विल डील विद दिस चैप्टर, व्हाट इज इग्नोरेंस, इट्स बाउंड्रीज इन ग्रेट डिटेल, बिकॉज दिस हैज अ ग्रेट इम्पॉर्टेंस फ्रॉम स्पिरिचुअल एंड अवर प्रैक्टिकल पॉइंट ऑफ व्यू. सो प्रैक्टिकल पॉइंट ऑफ व्यू, what is its importance, why Shrivindo is, it not just philosophy, because we may take it that ignorance shall be forever ignorance and we have to transit from here somehow to a state of knowledge. And what this knowledge is, we should be clear about these terms also. If that is so, then that means ignorance has no chance of changing into knowledge. You have to move from one to another. It sounds very strange, in fact illogical, if we look at even the facts of existence. So we see that a baby from the womb to the grave, there is a journey from ignorance to knowledge. It's constant there. May not be ultimate knowledge, but definitely a baby in the womb is almost in a state of matter-like inconscient. It doesn't know anything. And slowly there is emergence of knowledge, emergence of everything else, and so it journeys. Now where it reaches that end point may not be knowledge in the highest sense, but one thing we notice, because Shrivindo starts with facts of existence, something very beautiful is he is not just talking philosophy, which has nothing to do with our everyday life experience. That's why when he was asked that what should be termed your philosophy, if one has to call it philosophy, is it Advaita? Is it Dvaita? What do we call it? So use the word, if you want to use a word, you can use the word realistic Advaita. So there is a realism in it. So realistic is that, well, we are in a state of ignorance. Unless somebody is absolutely, outrightly foolish. Only foolish people believe that they know everything. It's the sign of height of foolishness. So we all, any which way, if we look at ourselves, we'll discover that we are in a state of ignorance. Second fact, is this our state which is destined to be permanent? Well, in human beings, there is a constant seeking for knowledge. It's inbuilt, inherent. And so there is also a movement from ignorance to knowledge. This we can say for sure. Third, where are we, what kind of knowledge are we seeking? Are we okay with this degree, that degree? No, there is a sense in us of some ultimate truth, instinct with it. We are constantly seeking some ultimate truth. We may use the word perfection, perfection of knowledge, perfection of peace, undisturbed, perfection of bliss. We may call it anything. But essentially, perfect state, a state of perfection. So we can reasonably assume that there is something called as a state where there is a perfection. I mean, we have arrived at a stable ground from which everything has emerged. Even logically, we can say there has to be a source from which the whole thing has emerged. And spiritual experience affirms or confirms that yes, there is indeed a self where there is what we can call as knowledge. And beyond knowledge and ignorance, but that leap we'll take a little later. So there is a state of knowledge and then there is a state of ignorance. Now, can ignorance be taken back to some original state? Yes, we can say that creation emerges from, that's what the Rig Veda speaks of, and even logically, some state where there is neither light nor darkness as we know it. Even logically, before light emerged, light is the first thing that emerges with the Big Bang. Light and sound, if you want to call it. Before space and time emerge, anything. So there is a state when everything is as if asleep. There is a potential, but nothing has emerged. So that is a state which can be called as inconscient. So there are these three things. There is the inconscient. What is inconscient? All knowledge, bliss, power is held back within it. That's what we read last time. That what is ignorance, slowly it is being released. And in Savitri, Shrivindo very beautifully describes in the very first canto that, this heedless mother, the inconscient, she's also a mother, Diti,
So she holds back the child to her apron strings. You know, like there are mothers who don't want their babies to, even when they are grown up. Where are you going? How much time you will take? When will you come back? So they don't. So it holds back. And then on the other hand, other is a ultimate truth. So there are different theories. One of the theories which is most common, and that's what Sri Aurobindo touches upon, and we'll close with this. We are just closing this chapter. So we'll just read this aspect, because what Sri Aurobindo says is, inconscient is knowledge held back. Again, power held back completely. And in real life we see this, that power is held back. What is atom? Atom contains a power which in the sun is revealed. But in the atom, in matter, it is held back. So this is a wonderful thing that divine has held back. And slowly he is releasing. Why he is doing it? Sri Aurobindo will answer it when the right time comes. But for the moment, on page 516, he explains, to know, we have always to dissolve the rigid constructions of the ignorant and self-willed intellect and look freely and flexibly at the facts of existence. Its fundamental fact is consciousness, which is power. Everywhere we see some degree of consciousness. It may be minuscule to vanishing. So people will say, how in the stone there is consciousness? If you look at the movement inside the atom, it behaves as if it knows that, well, outer orbit should be 2 or 8 electrons, and in the nucleus we have to balance of energies. Atom doesn't know, but all the constituent parts, as if it is held back a tremendous knowledge. So everywhere we see this knowledge, everywhere we see existence, Sat, everywhere we see Chit, which is consciousness as tapas and consciousness as force. Can we deny that there is no force? Even in the atom there is force. Even in the stone there is force. It's a different thing that you can either pick up a stone and break somebody's head with that force, or you can put a stone and invoke the deity and it turns into Shiva, Kedarnath. That choice is there with human beings, but it contains a force. So there is Sat, there is Chit tapas, and then can we deny there is Ananda? That's why even the avowed Mayavadin, who illusionist, he will not leave the world so easily. And nowadays he will travel all over the world in nice luxury class and go to say that world is Maya. Never. It is so strange and surprising. But then, because Sat Chit Ananda is not his fault, Ananda inspires, moves us. So all this, these are the facts. Now degree, extent is a different thing. So he said these are the facts. First, we find that there is a consciousness behind all, embracing all, within all, which is eternally, universally, absolutely aware of itself, whether in unity or multiplicity or in body simultaneously or beyond both in its sheer absolute. And of course, this is, he's speaking of the fact of spiritual experience. But even with us, it's very interesting. Say somebody is, having a bodily pain and you speak about, so there is the body and its awareness, which right now is in pain. And at that time, speak to the person about someone whom one really loves from the heart. Now you see, consciousness has shifted. It's the whole trick. And I personally love doing it with the elderly group. I just ask them, sometimes people don't understand, okay, tell us about your days when you came here and how was it with the mother. The eyes sparkle, the whole being changes. Are they two different persons? It's the same person. It's just that at every level there is a different kind of awareness. So there is the body, and there is a, to this extent one can go that one lives in the higher self or the highest self. One can completely become oblivious to all that is happening in the bodily state. That's the beauty. At the same time, one can be simultaneously aware of all these things. We know when Sri Aurobindo had the
fracture, and later on he was asked that, what were you doing? He was lying like a golden Purusha, as Nirodha describes beautifully. So what were you doing at that point of time? So he says that, well, I was trying to convert this intense physical pain into ananda. Only the Lord can think of that. So because he had done it, experienced it during when he went to Kolkata after that realization of Nirvana, Kolkata, I mean different places he was going. So he was stung by a scorpion and he converted that pain into ananda, and very beautifully he has written a poem on that, Meditations of Mandapya. And he says that the scorpion stings and the mind says, got ensnared by the form and says, ah, it is painful. But instantly the higher self comes in and says, but it is the touch of my beloved, the Lord. And it changes into ananda. And it gives us such a secret. So much in life problems can be over if we experience that, or at least try to live that truth. That it is nobody else. It is our own self. The whole game is taking place here, that my rival's downfall is my own disgrace. I look at my enemy and see Krishna's face. Wonderful, that would be. So this is one self. Next, at the other pole of things, we see this consciousness dwelling upon apparent oppositions in itself. And the most extreme antinomy of all reaches its acme in what seems to us to be a complete nescience of itself, an effective, dynamic, creative inconscience. On the other pole, we know that this is how dust in itself cannot create anything, and yet dust does create everything, because there is all the knowledge held back in the inconscient state. And in between the two, we find between these two oppositions, and as a mediary term, we see consciousness working with a partial, limited self-awareness, which is equally superficial, for behind it and acting through it is the divine all-knowledge. So these are the three things which we can observe very easily. Based on this, people have made different theories, and the most common one, all these Mayavadis. Mayavadis means ultimately, they may not use the word Maya, but ultimately say you have to come out of this world. All of them, they have this instinctively, if you go into its depth, that there is a realm which is meant to be forever dark and nothing you can do about it, very powerful. In fact, it is originally, there is a very interesting history of it. And there is a realm where there is freedom, moksha, or whatever else. Now this is called Manichean principle, and you'll find mention in Savitri. So a Manichean double creator. So there is a darkness and their life is miserable, will be miserable, and the fellow out there is extremely powerful. And different people will call it different names. One of the names, for example, is Kal. Not Kal is time. But he holds back. And they have fantastic theories that, he somehow gobbled up the souls, or they will give it into him. And once he's there, nothing can be done. Only some people can escape. By the special grace of the master, there will be a method, a process, and some souls can escape, but this will remain. This is called the Manichean principle, and it has a very interesting, actually it should be Manichean, I don't know the exact, because this was, in Persia we had the Ahur Mazda, where there is a darkness and there is light, so in Ahur Mazda. Now, its extreme took place ultimately. The whole thing developed ultimately into a Manichean creator, wherein there is a dark principle, eternally it will remain dark, and there is an eternal good principle. I use the word for this person who, Mani, his name is M-A-N-I, I don't know how to pronounce it. From there this term comes, Shobhindu mentions that. So Mani gave this principle, here there is always darkness. And there is light and freedom. So doesn't matter, don't question why it has come. You have to quit, find a way of exit. In all the different mokshavadi philosophies or method, ultimately it comes to
what Sri Aurobindo calls that in the next, that we have to reconcile. It might even be that an absolute knowledge establishing truth, harmony, order, and an absolute inconscience basing a play of fantasy, disharmony and disorder, supporting inexorably its extreme of falsehood, wrong and suffering, a Manichean double principle. And that created so much chaos. Ultimately this as a religion it went off. It was discarded. But it is reborn. It continues to live. That there is a realm of darkness. Ye duniya mere sasural. This continues. What an impact this man had. So he gave this principle, and Sri Aurobindo speaks of it in Savitri when he describes the parable of the search of the soul. And there he says that this Manichean creator can completely create total chaos in the world. This is how it is believed. And then he closes very beautifully, but there is a guardian power, there are hands that save, calm eyes divine regard the human scene. So, a Manichean double principle of conflicting and intermingling light and darkness. So, always in the world there is fight going on between light and darkness. Good and evil stand at the roots of cosmic existence. Even in Purana you will see some touch of it. Who is first created by Lord Vishnu? In his sleep. He is sleeping. And Lord Brahma suddenly discovers, I have come out of him. Who am I? Why am I? And suddenly out of Lord Vishnu in his sleep, there emerge two demons. Madhu Kaitav. They are the fellows who emerge first. It is very interesting, the whole story. So they emerge and what do? They are wanting to, you know, destroy things, whatever. And then Brahmaji wakes him up. Vishnu Bhagwan. There is a whole stuti. And then he wakes up. For 5,000 years, he fights with this Madhu and Kaitab. They are also very powerful. So finally, he does a yukti. It's a very touching story. If one reads it casually, it's difficult to understand. But anyways, we'll not go into details of the story because I've taken this in Bhagavad Puran. So at the end, Vishnu Bhagwan says, and here Mother Saraswati comes in, that why are you continuing the fight? You are enjoying it, but let's finish it. So Lord Vishnu says, okay, you have won. Ask whatever boon you want to ask. Really? No, he doesn't. He says, ki, you have won. You are almighty. He says, really? He says, yes. He says, okay. You ask whatever boon you want to ask. They ask Lord Vishnu. So Vishnu Bhagwan says, sure, yes. And there is a very interesting principle in this. So Vishnu Bhagwan says, I wish to see you die on my thighs. What? Okay, but they are almighty fellows. They grant the boon. And they die on the thighs of Lord Vishnu. That's why you will hear in Madhukaita Bhari, there is Madhusudana. That's where the name comes. Very strange, because Madhu normally, so Madhukaita Bhari. Now, this is something very interesting. Mother, this, for a long time, it used to kind of torment me that what is this? Why is he not winning this battle? And then this doubt, intellectually I had got cleared intuitively. But how to confirm it? Mother confirms it in one of her writings, very interesting writings. There she is asked that why doesn't divine finish all these asuras? She says the fastest way to finish them is to let them have their way. And then she explains they get bloated and bloated and bloated by the ego. And they think they are supreme. But they are not the supreme. They start believing they are supreme. So they want to stretch and then they burst. And they collapse. It explains so many things. And that's why Shri Krishna's very cryptic statement in the Gita, which was another for me, like, why has he said so? Because it apparently goes as if in contradiction to what Sri Aurobindo says, but actually it is perfectly in line. So he says that to those who are good, I and remember me, I give them better and better births and release them. And incidentally, there is a clause in that both the Gita and Bhagavad Puran mentions, those whom God loves, what does he do? He snatches away money. He snatches away relatives. It's very fascinating. He snatches away. Of course, Tagore said, Jake tumi bahite chaho apar premier bhar, eke bare sabhe tumi ghochay dao thar. But snatches away because anything you are attached to, that will be taken away. Of course, Madan and Shrivinda are very loving. They do it very nicely, gently. You don't get to know. But otherwise, so what does Shri Krishna say? What does he do? But those who do not take heed, who do not abandon the way of darkness, he casts them more and more into asuric birth. That means they become more and more virulent, more and more violent, more and more aggressive, till they touch rock bottom. And when they touch rock bottom, then they say, Hari, Ma. And then I quickly, the moment they start remembering God, they should be regarded as my devotee and not as someone dark, because quickly I release them. This is such an interesting, fascinating thing, and one can actually see it in the world. So Manichean principle applies in all these states, that there is an almighty darkness, but this almightiness is only a appearance. But typical Manichean thing is, no, there is, you cannot do anything about it. But so what does Sri Aurobindo say? Sri Aurobindo says, but if we find that knowledge and ignorance are light and shadow of the same consciousness, that the beginning of ignorance is a limitation of knowledge. See, that's where it's hidden there. That it is the limitation that opens the door to a subordinate possibility of partial illusion and error, that this possibility takes full body after a purposeful plunge of knowledge into a material inconscience. But this knowledge too emerges along with an emerging consciousness out of the inconscience, then we can be sure that the fullness of ignorance is by its own evolution changing back into a limited knowledge, and can feel the assurance that the limitation itself will be removed and the full truth of things become apparent, the cosmic truth free itself from the cosmic ignorance. Such beautiful, clear logic. What it means is, practically, baby in the womb, well, seed in the womb. Does it know it's a baby? No, it doesn't know. Forget about parents. It doesn't even know what it is. Everyday life we'll see it. Then slowly, slowly, slowly it is emerged. Then it's born. It still doesn't know. In the womb it doesn't know, but it's growing. So there is a journey in ignorance where it doesn't know. Then it starts kicking. That's what many of us get into, in a kicking. What is this world? Oh, this, that. So when we kick, what does the mother say? Wait, hold on. You'll come out. You're my baby. I'll take care. Then there is a labor pain. This is a real life journey. Again, the baby is poor fellow, doesn't know. He doesn't even know how to breathe. Then he comes out. What does the mother do? Mother gives it milk. Straight. What is she doing? This is her way to help consciousness emerge. And when consciousness emerges, then the same baby, which was kicking, which was didn't know, that baby begins to say, Mama, Ma, I love you. Still it doesn't know what it means. When it grows up, because as a child he will go through difficult passages, when Mama will be the worst Mama on earth. But when it grows, becomes 30, 40, then it says, Mama, none like you. See, this is a journey. So everyday life, this Veda is shown to us. It's Veda. Veda is everywhere. So if we really look at life, we will understand the Veda. Inconscient, ignorance, knowledge. When the baby recognizes Mama, then it's knowledge. So this is what Sri Aurobindo closes this chapter with. So this is the essence of this chapter. And then he enters into the next chapter, chapter 8. Memory, self-consciousness and the ignorance. So now he'll develop ignorance, all its different functioning. Now, why he's taking up this? This may look like apparently suddenly why he's taking up this memory. What has memory got to do? It has a lot to do. But before that, we have seen that in the chapter on cosmic illusion, reality and illusion, Sri Aurobindo has taken up the traditional Shankara's Advaitic Vedantic point of view. Now there is another which is paradoxically apparently different but ends up with the same proposition that the world is an illusion. But it doesn't use the word illusion. It says, what is this world? It's a string of memory and formation, and through that creation is moving endlessly in time. What is beyond it? Nothing. How it came into existence? Buddha. Now comes Buddha. He says you don't have to worry about it. How it came into existence? A metaphysical question. Do you see why metaphysics is important? Because he says, why you want to worry about it? Is there suffering? Dukkha? Yes, there is dukkha. So if there is dukkha, you want a solution for dukkha? Yes, we want a solution for dukkha. Okay, I'll give you the solution for dukkha is the Eightfold Path. And what is the ultimate solution? Nirvana. Now, this is very appealing to a kind of practical mentality. He says, what does it matter? I want to get out of this world of suffering. Of course, if you read the Vishnu Puran, the incarnation of Buddha is described as Maya Moho. And Sri Aurobindo at one place in evening talk says, Buddha came to take the asuras away from creation. And at the beginning it will appear, but you know, suffering, what about asura? They are the most suffering people. If you look at all these, even recently, the protest and all those abusive, you'll feel they are the most suffering people. Who will be always angry? I mean, they are throwing their anger once in a while on people. You can take it or leave it. But they are living it, bathing in it. And I've seen this, that many of these people are very unhappy inside, whatever be the reason. And therefore, Buddha says, isn't the world full of suffering? Yes. Come out. Okay. So he came to take the asuras out of the creation. Sri Aurobindo's in this thing. So I'm not saying that all Buddhist practitioners are that, but just one of the things. So then we come to memory. Again, just as knowledge and ignorance have different meaning when we come to spiritual understanding. Similarly, memory, self-consciousness and the ignorance have a different connotation when we speak about spiritual term, because we are not talking here about mechanisms of memory in the human body. Memory is everywhere. Memory is in the cell. There is short-term memory, long-term memory. No. Memory here is about, very simply, if somebody says, were you there yesterday? Yes, of course. And if somebody says, who were you yesterday? He says, you have gone crazy. Please get checked by Dr. Alok Pandey, the nearest one we know. Is this a question to be asked? Who are you yesterday? I am the same person. It's a nice story about it. This memory, how the memory can operate and memory comes. Many times we'll see Smriti Labdha. Gita speaks about it. So there is a story of a guru and a disciple, and the disciple one day says, I have been hearing you very often. He doesn't say bored, but I want to go out and experience the world. He says, okay, go. So he goes into the world, he's enjoying all this. And one day the guru says, this fellow must be brought back. So the disciple is there, and disciple is no more disciple outwardly. He forget, but the master never forgets. So that day, king is coming on an elephant. And the guru sneaks in. He recognizes the disciple. Taps him on the shoulder, says, hey, what's happening? Can you tell me? He doesn't recognize the master. He says, you can see for yourself.
the king is coming with the elephant. He said, oh, where is the king and where is the elephant? Who is the king and who is the elephant? He said, "Are you are a fool. Elephant is one who is below. And king is he? He is sitting above." He said, "Oh, I see. Okay, what is below and above?" Now he is very annoyed. He catches hold of his master, puts him down, and sits over him, and says, "You are below, I am above." So master says one last question. "Who is you and who am I?" Then suddenly he has the remembrance. "Oh my God, my master." Many stories like that, plenty, you know, of suddenly the memory coming back. It's Smriti Labdha. So what really is memory? It applies at every level actually. And some people, unfortunately, memory prolongs. See, time is a stream which is carrying everything forward. That's what when Buddha, very beautifully, when somebody shouted at him, went away. Two little stories again to get that gist of what memory is. So next day he felt sad that why did I talk to him like that. So he came to Buddha and said, "I'm sorry." He said, "About what?" He said, "I shouted at you. I got very angry." Buddha says, "That's gone. That went away with that moment. I seek forgiveness." So he says, "For what? That is gone." And there is another even more beautiful story. How memory plays a role in prolonging things. Time is moving forward, but we get stuck. It has practical implication. And certain forms of therapy make it worse. You go back into the past trauma, real or unreal, nobody knows. So past trauma. So there are stories like that where how something has happened in the past. So a guru is going with disciples crossing a stream and he sees a woman caught in the stream. She is in a bad state. So guru comes, he's ahead. He picks up the woman on his shoulders, carries her across, puts her on the bank, and they all thank you, little bit exchange of pleasantry and go away. Not disciples. Guru ji ne chua hi nahi, upar utha liya, kandhe mein le liya. He has done all this unspeakable thing. So they are carrying it in their head. After 2-3 days, the guru said, "What is it? You people are carrying something. You can ask me." So one of them says, "Sir, we are wondering at your behavior." "What is the behavior?" "You not only touched, you could have held the woman, maybe shown her how to go, you carried her on your shoulders." So guru says, "Oh, that. Are, I left her there, you are still carrying her." So memory is like a string which joins certain things from the past to the present, but doesn't extend into the future. So it can become a, so it works both ways. If we remember who we are, that's how lines of Savitri, "Remember why thou camest," then there is a revelation. But normally, ordinarily, the memory operates at this surface level. So it can become a bondage, it can become a, if you have the true memory, that's what many people, when they come to ashram, they don't understand why they experienced it. And sometimes there are wise people who say, no, all this is imagination. What do they experience? I have heard people say this. "I felt home. There was a lady I know who was going to die 6 months. Finally, she died after 2 years. And she somehow came to ashram. Psychologist used to come to my room in Command Hospital, saw the pictures, came here. Her life changed. And she would say, "I can't share all this with anyone because nobody will believe." But she says, "I cried when I went to the ashram. I don't know why. I felt this is my home." "Why did I feel so?" I said, "It's your home." So she said, "But that's not my home." I said, "That's your true home. One day you will come here, because this is what
The other day we are saying original home, that's what mother has created. At least here itself we can arrive at that point from where we have departed. A supramental world in the making. So memory, then self-consciousness and the ignorance. So which self are we in? Based on that we experience. In any survey of the dual character of a consciousness, that is ignorance and knowledge, we have first to look at the ignorance. For ignorance trying to turn into knowledge is our normal status. So first we have to look at memory from that ignorance point of view and the role it plays. He's not speaking of Smriti Labdha right now. To begin with, it is necessary to consider some of the essential movements of this partial awareness of self and things, which works in us as a mediator between the complete self-knowledge and all knowledge, and the complete inconscience, and from that starting point find its relation to the greater consciousness below our surface. Now he takes up basically its portion of how Buddhist thought would work. There is a line of thought in which great stress is laid upon the action of memory. It has even been said that memory is the man. It is memory that constitutes a personality and holds cemented the foundation of a psychological being. We all know this. So yesterday I was this, day before. Oh, he is my enemy. Why? Because 10 years back he told me something. He is my friend, even though he continues to cheat you, still he is your friend. Why? Because he is my friend. So all this continues in our mind as an action of memory. It has a tendency to continue from the past into the present. It is the regarded sometimes as a string on which life is flowing. It is the bank of time. This is an idea which takes its stand on our existence in the succession of time and accepts process as the key to essential truth. This is exactly what Buddhism is, Buddhist thought is, but he is putting it in a very technical term. Even when it does not regard the whole of existence as process or as cause and effect in the development of some kind of self-regulating energy or karma, past karma, present, before that, past. And it's two ways we can look at it. It speaks of cause as what happened before and effect as what is happening now. But actually, if you change your perspective, and often I use this example, because this example flashed in my mind, that supposing you stand on a road, you see a car coming and a cycle man going ahead, and the car suddenly comes too dangerously close and you believe it's going to hit, and it hits. It's, oh my God, the car fellow, you know, hit and he was blind. This is how we'll analyze sad event. But if you had a satellite image, all the coordinates, car is leaving the home at this speed, is traveling. If you know the intent of the driver, his state. If you know that this is how the driver is going to do things because this is a state of awareness, you can predict almost with a near accuracy. So it all depends upon, so was it cause and effect or was it predetermined? The person had to go through an experience. This is something which we have to consider later on. Shobindo will at its own time take up all these questions. So this is the one idea, that there is a self-regulating energy of karma which is going on. Few lines below, but memory is only a process of consciousness, a utility. It cannot be the substance of being. Why he is using the word process of consciousness? Because, well, we know that in unconscious state, even most ordinarily, memory is not being laid. But even in the most unconscious element, there is consciousness. So there is memory. And that is the principle behind relics. Not just relics like body part, those divya deyansh. Not only that, anything touched or used by someone becomes a relics. By someone I mean the great ones. It is relics. That's why we have movies on that. Indiana Jones, Cup of Christ. Why they are relics? It's not a memory. Some people believe it's a memory. No, it carries the imprint. It carries the memory of that contact. And if there is somebody receptive, you can actually receive it. Shobindu goes on to say that a sword which has been used to kill people 300 years back is lying in the museum. You can, by touching the sword, know all that it has done, all the events, all the killings, everything you can get. It is imprinted inside. So even in unconsciousness, why? Because it's an act of consciousness. Consciousness, you cannot destroy consciousness, is the last thing. Energy also cannot be destroyed. At one level, even matter cannot be destroyed, but it can be resolved into energy. And consciousness has the real memory, and that will explain many, many things in life which today we don't understand. And even what can be called as a kind of love at first sight. Now, it's because there is a memory which wakes up. Shobindu speaks of love as that. A memory wakes in our inconscient stuff. So there is a very wonderful subject. But here he is speaking of it. Why? It's not memory. It's the consciousness which wakes up. Memory is only a trigger. Memory wakes up. And then consciousness comes alive. So memory is a process of consciousness, a utility. It cannot be the substance of being or the whole of our personality. It is simply one of the workings of consciousness, as radiation is one of the workings of light. So he clarifies that. It's not really memory. Memory is a process. What is it that wakes up? Consciousness wakes up. A consciousness which was lying asleep. Something triggers and it wakes up. More often than not, it's the wrong things that get triggered. Seeing people. But there is a deeper trigger. The mist was torn between two lives. As he says, we see that there are two applications which the mind makes of its faculty or process of memory. Memory of self, memory of experience, as we know. First, radically, it applies memory to the fact of our conscious being and relates that to time. It says, I am now, I was in the past, I shall therefore be in the future. It is the same I in all the three ever unstable divisions of time. Even this is a meditation which is so powerful and wonderful. And there are several ways. Mother has given this in different ways. So supposing somebody says something, it hurts you. Always there will be something which will hurt. And the narrower we are, the more frequently we get hurt. So then when you... and weakness, you know, sensitivity, hyper. So what do you do? You are feeling hurt, you are likely to get angry. Then what do you do? Inner operation, I am mother's child. I am the mother's child. Mother's child, is this how you will behave? Get angry, get into a brawl. Something will stop you. At one place someone told the mother, Mother, that fellow is constantly insulting me every time I go out, because you know, she accuses or abuses something. What should I do? I am thinking of changing the place. Mother's answer. This the person himself has told me. So mother's answer was, thus my child, the soul is never insulted. It is only the ego that feels insulted. Now what happens? Suddenly you realize, oh, I am not this little fellow. I am the self. I am the child of the mother. How can I be afraid? How can I be insulted? I am beyond it. So there is a continuity of the self. The moment we do that, it gives us a vantage point. So this memory of self. Thus it tries to render to itself in the terms of time an account of that which it feels to be the fact, but cannot know or prove to be true the eternity of the conscious being. When we say, I am mother's child, you ask, prove it. But this is so true to you. It was, then when you look back at your past, you discover, yes, that's my truth. And this will be your truth in the future. So to live by that, remember why thou camest, to remember the goal always. These are practices. If you just remember the goal, most problems will go away. Because then immediately if something happens in life, you'll remember why I am here, okay, I'm here for this. So it'll change. So these are things of practical importance. Shobhinda is giving us the philosophical or the spiritual basis of it. By memory, mind can only know of itself in the past by direct self-awareness, and he accepts that initially it'll be the mind which will say so. Only in the moment of the present, and it is only by extension and inference from this self-awareness and from the memory which tells us that for some time awareness has been continuously existent, that mind can conceive of itself in the future. So usually it is the mind which is relates with the present, and that's why many methods are like live in the present. But we must understand, we may live in the foolish present. It's not prolonging our foolishness, but live in the eternal present. Because present is a moment which is real. So by living in the present means living in your highest self. It can be turned into. It is not going to explain everything or solve all the problems of things. But at least this is one of the practices. At least it will cut away many things, many problems of life. Somebody comes, you meet a person on the road, see this fellow, why he has crossed my path. Now when you live in the present, you are walking past so happily. How does it matter? He was, I was, but I am. That's it. It changes. It's a very good practice actually, very good practice. Every time it draws, we can remember that. Okay, so on the next page, and with this, we will stop this session. These questions, our surface mind by itself has no means of solving. It can only speculate upon them endlessly and arrive at more or less well-reasoned opinions. The belief in our immortality is only a faith. The belief in our mortality is only a faith. You'll say, how? Ask. Have you died? No, I have not died. Why do you believe you will die? Others died. That's their business. That's their business. Do you have the experience of death? No, I don't have experience. So what is it? It's faith. Faith that everything ends up after death. When people say so, I ask them, is it faith or is it logic? Logically, you cannot. Now, of course, we are able to prove, and Aurobindo speaks of that also, few lines below. And this is in 1914, 15, 16, 17, whenever he's writing, in the previous century, he says, survival of the body by the human personality may hereafter be proved even to the satisfaction of the skeptic. It's around that time that research in after-death experience started. Dr. Raymond Moody did a lot of studies on near-death, after-death. Famous videos came. And now it's like many people believe that yes, something of the human personality survives after death. But then he's writing it may hereafter. Does that prove the self? No, it still does not prove the self. That is the other part of it. It proves that there is a survival of the something of the personality after death. Now this is how Aurobindo takes it to the ultimate thing. So it may be proved. But even then, what will be established will only be a greater continuity and not the eternity of the conscious being. So why he is bringing this little thing? Because that's how Buddhism puts it. It believes in rebirth. But it doesn't believe in individual soul, doesn't believe in the eternal self. At least I was fascinated to understand the logic. Kya logic hai? Rebirth is there. So it speaks of these energy formations which come and they, you know, they are drawn, attracted, all kinds of interesting theories. So what is really reborn? Ultimately, there is a question mark. It's not to your satisfaction. But there is no eternal self. So this past life, rebirth, only explains that there is survival after death. All is not destroyed. But is there, what is reborn? Is there an eternal self? It does not answer. So with this, we can stop. From all this, one great fact emerges.
that the very nature of a mind is ignorance, not an absolute nescience, but a limited and conditioned knowledge of being. So we cannot understand all this purely as long as we live in the mind alone. So we'll continue after 10 minutes, 6:15. Chema.